I'm Joe Dante.
Legendary director Joe Dante.
And I'm Josh Olson.
Oscar-nominated screenwriter Josh Olson.
And nobody loves movies as much as we do.
Nobody's sane.
And we have a podcast.
Each episode, we track down other filmmakers, comedians, rock stars, authors, and artists, and talk to them about movies.
But not about their movies. Everybody does that.
We talk to them about the movies they love and the movies that have, well,
made them who they are.
Which is why we call our show The Movies That Made Me.
From legendary giants to this year's Oscar winners.
We know them all and we've seen them all.
So check out The Movies That Made Me, the Movie Lovers Podcast.
Available everywhere you find good podcasts. Well, actually, it's available wherever you find podcasts, even the bad ones, but ours is really good.
That's the idea.
He had sent me two scripts. He gave me Pretty in Pink and a script called The New Kid, which is about his experience when they had to move to Arizona and go to a new high school. And Pretty in Pink made me cry. So I said, I think I should do this one. So that was it. It was lock script. The only thing that changed was the ending.
Welcome back to Light the Fuse presents The Directors, where we, and by we I mean myself, Drew Taylor, and my always fabulous co-host Charles Hood, go through classic films in the Paramount Library and the filmmakers who brought them to life. And Charles, who are we talking to today?
We are talking to, this is just part one of our chat with Howard Deutsch, the director of Pretty in Pink and Some Kind of Wonderful. And this week is mostly about Pretty in Pink, the classic written and produced by John Hughes, starring Molly Ringwald and John Cryer. And this is an essential 80s teen comedy, wouldn't you say? It's actually more dramatic than a lot of the other John Hughes movies, actually, in this case.
Well, I think they always kind of, they all have their comedic elements and their dramatic elements.
Yes.
And I think this one is no different. Howard was very gracious with his time and told us a lot of great anecdotes that I had never heard before. And I'm sure you had never heard before either, Charles.
Yeah, it's great. I mean, some wonderful stories that we'll get into in the interview and then we can talk a little bit about afterwards.
I think that's a great idea, Charles. I think we should get into it right now and we'll be back right afterwards. Howard, we're so excited to chat with you. We are such big fans and have been for so long. But I think one of the things we're really fascinated about in your career is just your relationship with John Hughes and how that started. Like how did he come to you, or did you come to him? And because at the time he was cranking out so many scripts, he couldn't physically direct them all, right? Isn't that part of what the problem was?
Maybe partially, but mostly it was just that we met because I was making, at that point in my life, movie trailers with our company. And we worked on with John on 16 Candles and Breakfast Club. And yes, I guess you're right. In fact, I never thought of it like that. Yeah, he had a couple of scripts that he wanted to produce, not just direct. And so that's how all that started. Yeah.
And he was from the ad world as well.
Exactly.
Did you guys have a kinship there?
Yes, exactly. No film school for either of us. More kind of learned, trial by fire in the streets. And
wow, really rough out there.
And advertising, because I came from advertising. I was in the advertising department at United Artists,
Okay. Studio
in New York. And so we had that, I wouldn't say a kinship, but I think he liked that, you know, part of it. He didn't ever go to film school either. So, yeah, we had that in common.
Yeah. And so what was that? I mean, people write about his kind of hot and cold relationship with people where he'll be super into you and then kind of like, it sounds sort of like a teenager's kind of emotional vibe. What was that like with you?
We were pretty good for a long time, and I would say finished good, but I saw that in other relationships, but not unlike a lot of people. You know, the teenager part of it is all true. You know, that's how I feel like he was able to so beautifully write those characters, you know, who are in the teen part of his life and capture kind of an authenticity that other people have never quite have like he does with those characters, because he kept that part of him alive, and he had it was a big part of his creativity.
Wow. Well, let's talk about your first film and your first film with him, which was Pretty in Pink. I mean, what was that experience like for you?
Well, how did you get the job too? Because had you directed anything before that?
Yeah, well, I had directed theater, Ensemble Studios Theater in New York, which was basically a couple of one-act plays, because I wanted to learn how to work with actors better, and there was a program at Ensemble Studios Theater where I was part of it, and the final exam was putting on some one-act plays. And then I was in New York when John had Pretty in Pink, the script. The question was, had I directed before that? Yes, I had directed. Joel Silver, producer, who I knew pretty well. Joel wanted me to do a music, what was called, they got this new thing called a music video and you're going to do it. And I said, I'm not going to do that. I don't want to do that. He said, well, you worked on the trailer. I'll be there every day. You just do it. And he didn't show up ever. And so I did this video for Rumblefish. And I was terrified. You know, it's not something that I had done before. And it was, you know, Stuart Copeland from The Police and all that. So it was a big deal. And but I got through it, and I kind of liked the way it turned out. And so did other people. So then I went on and did other music videos. I did a Billy Idol video. I did a Billy Joel video. I did a video, most importantly, for John for 16 Candles. And he liked it. And so did Ned Tanen at Paramount. And that kind of paved the path for Pretty in Pink.
Oh, wow. But that makes sense, though, because that era, like that sensibility, too, was something that people were really looking for at the time, right? That kind of music video, that not only the musicality, but also the kind of quick cutting. And obviously, that movie has so much music in it.
I don't know. I think part of it was I was just lucky, like 90% is luck, honestly, and in the right place, because the trailer business, we were so successful, and we were doing Apocalypse Now, and we had done a lot of huge movies, and I kind of learned about what I didn't get out of film school by osmosis, by looking at rough cuts of movies all the time, you know, and having to do the trailers. So between working on Scorsese movies and Woody Allen movies and Coppola's movies and so on, I think that I got a little notoriety like that, frankly. And at that point in cinema history, in the mid-80s, late 70s, mid 80s, it was still a big deal, the trailer business. And I mean, you know, I'd come out to show a trailer, and then I went to dinner at Spago. I had more kind of attention than I ever had as a director, because they were counting on trailers to get people into the theaters. It was a big deal. And so we were hot. We were doing those big movies. And so I had that kind of recognition. And I guess when I started directing music videos, the combination play to that gave me a little entree, a little bit of like, who's that guy kind of thing, you know, which I'll take whatever, whatever you can do to get some kind of recognition, to get a chance.
Did you cut a trailer for a movie that you knew was lousy, but the trailer was really good and it got a lot of people in the theater?
Like all the time, like most of the time. And my, also, I should give, you know, credit. It wasn't just me. It was my partner, Gary Canoe, and Billy Manger, and myself. It was three of us who owned this company. And you know, we were really, I never expected it to happen. Because I was let go when Orion was formed and all the executives left United Artists. And I was the last rat on the ship at United Artists. And then I got fired. And I just did it as a stopgap kind of thing. They invited me in, my friend Jeff Canoe and his brother Gary. And I did this trailer thing just to be able to pay the rent. And it grew and grew and became really successful. So I have more notoriety about that than at that point in history. Not that that happens now. Eventually the studios took that all, became in-house operations, and it was different. But yes, all the time. Trailers for movies that were terrible. Absolutely.
Are there any great movies that you did trailers for that you're really proud of, or or that you can name drop.
We love a good trailer. Yeah,
sure. I love name dropping. Yeah, no, we would all of Warren Beatty. We did Reds. We did most of Coppola's Apocalypse, One from the Heart. You know, we did Redford, Natural, a lot of stuff with Robert Redford. Jeff Canoe went on to be the editor of Ordinary People, Redford's movie. Bob Benton. I mean, the list goes on. Woody Allen's movies. Woody Allen used to say when I showed up is to do a trailer, like for Manhattan, I came in, he had his cutting room and this hotel, and I'd show up early. It's 7 a.m. he wanted to meet, and I'd get there and he'd be playing chess with Mia Farrow, normal stuff like that at 7 a.m. And he'd say, so are you here to rape my film again? Which is like of the last times. Yeah. And it was
nothing weird about that though.
but it was like, yeah, you know, he was right. You know, it was like, okay, in a sense, if I want to do this, I got to stop. I was ready to get out of it because the pressure that I felt having to get, because it was on me and our company most of the time, because posters and print ads don't open movies. It was the trailer and the TV campaign that became an enormous thing. And the more high budget movies became the type of movies being made, the more pressure I kept feeling. And I finally was like, I can't do it anymore. Mm-hmm. So not that you asked that, but I'm just thinking about that. So, yeah.
But that was a time when trailers were really an art in themselves, too. I mean, they were really wonderful. Now they're all sort of the same and give away the whole movie. But back then there was a real craft to it.
Yeah, no, I agree. I agree.
We'll be back with more from Howard Deutsch after the break.
Hi, I'm Joe Dante.
Legendary director Joe Dante.
And I'm Josh Olson.
Oscar-nominated screenwriter Josh Olson.
And nobody loves movies as much as we do.
Nobody's sane.
And we have a podcast.
Each episode, we track down other filmmakers, comedians, rock stars, authors, and artists, and talk to them about movies.
But not about their movies. Everybody does that.
We talk to them about the movies they love and the movies that have, well,
made them who they are.
Which is why we call our show The Movies That Made Me.
From legendary giants to this year's Oscar winners.
We know them all and we've seen them all.
So check out The Movies That Made Me, the Movie Lovers Podcast.
Available everywhere you find good podcasts. Well, actually, it's available wherever you find podcasts, even the bad ones. But ours is really good.
That's the idea.
Check out our new NBA show, Beyond the Arc, part of the CBS Sports Podcast Network, where you can find me, John Gonzalez, NBA insider Bill Reiter, and Ashley Nicole Moss, 5 days a week talking all things NBA. Whether you're looking for insightful discussions, upbeat commentary, breaking news, interviews, or coverage of all the biggest stories in the NBA, our new show is the place to be 5 days a week. Download and follow Beyond the Arc on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
All right, let's get into Pretty in Pink. a Paramount classic for sure. I think Charles and I both want to know what it was like working with Tak Fujimoto.
Yes, on that movie. The great cinematographer. We love him so much.
Great question, because he was one of the greatest decisions of my life, because he was fantastic in every way you can be a teacher, in every way you can be a friend, and in every way to save my life on my first movie, because it was my first movie and I was terrified and didn't know what I was doing. You know, I mean, it's not a music video. It's a movie. It's a whole other thing. Mm-hmm. And I had been working. I had been in Milton Katselis's class for a while, an acting class that a lot of people, my uncle, who's an actor, suggested I go in there and start to, you know, direct scenes in that class. And Milton agreed to let me in. And it was a great class. So my work with actors, I was prepared for, but really nothing else, you know? Of course I didn't say that to any of those guys who hired me, but that's how I felt. So, I interviewed a lot of DPs, so many, I can't even tell you. And I loved his work with Demme, Jonathan Demme. So I asked him to come, and he came in and he's very quiet and he wouldn't talk. I said, listen, Tak, I'm that kind of guy. I got to talk about stuff. And I'm feeling very, you know, nervous about this. So talk to me. And he wouldn't talk. Hardly. He said, you know, nothing. And So he left. And I said, I can't do that. And then I met more people. And then I kept thinking about him. And I said, would you come back? Came back. I said, okay, all I'm asking is you talk a little and then we can do this. No. Wouldn't he just, not his style to just talk. And he got up to leave and he turned around at the door and he said, I really need this job. And it was something about that moment. I don't know. I said, I gotta do this. And I did.
Wow.
And then from that moment on, he never shut up. It was nothing but the greatest advice, whatever it was.
Wow.
I remember when we first went location scouting, I said, I don't know. What do you think? He said, well, what do you think? I said, I don't know. Does it work for camera? And he's like, what do you feel? What's the scene about? What do you want it to set? You know, all that stuff that he's such an artist about. And so from every aspect of filmmaking, he supported me and I learned from him so much. And how especially his genius about shooting comedy and not trying to be funny with the camera.
Right. Well, and he shot Ferris Bueller as well. Was this shot before Ferris?
Yes.
So you brought talk to John Hughes then and for Ferris. Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. Then not enough that I can say about him. That's just a special, special guy. And one of the greatest cinematographers I've ever seen, let alone work with.
So what was the biggest takeaway from that interaction with him? Was it technical? Was it like learning about lenses or was it like something kind of more profound?
No. That's the thing about Tack. He was like, just tell me what the scene's about. You know, if I said, are you going to use a 40mm? What kind of lens? And he was like, don't worry about it. Let's talk about what the scene's about. Is it, should it feel, threatening to the character? Should it be, should they be moved? Are they sad? Tell me what you want, what you think the scene's about. And it was always from that he would make decisions about how to shoot it. And literally he did, it was so interesting. He'd just go like this with his hand when we're on a location, put out his fist, 300 people would show up right there. And that's where the lens goes, right where his fist was. And he didn't have to say much. It was everybody respected him so much that it was just, they'd kill for him. And fast and decisive. Never, I worked with him in 3 movies. So I remember by the time we did Grumpy Old Men, he was getting ready to retire. Oh, no, I'm sorry. It was Replacements, that movie that we did together that he was getting ready to retire. But he stayed on, I think, after a couple of years longer to work with that director who did, what's his name?
Shyamalan?
Yeah, Shyamalan, yeah.
Yeah, he did Signs and another one with him, I think.
Yeah. But I mean, I could talk this whole...
about Tack.
He's the guy. You got the right guy for me to,
Drew and I have always been big fans of his work.
Yeah.
So the ending, obviously, we'll get to that later because that is a very big story that the ending changed. But putting that aside for now, when the script showed up for you, like how close is the movie to what the script was that you got? How much did it change during pre-production? Or was it basically like, this is the script, we're going to go shoot it?
No, that's the script. I mean, he had sent me 2 scripts. He gave me Pretty in Pink and a script called The New Kid, which is about his experience when they had to move to Arizona and go to a new high school. And I don't know, I read Pretty in Pink made me cry. So I said, I think I should do this one. So that was it. It was Locke's script. The only thing that changed was the ending.
Right. What about the script made you cry? Which was the... I mean, there's so much in it. It's interesting because it's kind of... It's more dramatic, I think, than a lot of the other teen movies he did at the time, I feel like.
Yeah.
I mean, I guess John Cryer gives us a lot of comedy, but I feel like Molly Ringwald and Andrew McCarthy and Harry Dean Stanton, like there's a lot of dramatic stuff in this movie. I feel like there's more of a balance toward comedy in some of the other movies at the time.
Yeah. Well, John's funnier than me. I mean, John's funny. I mean, as a just a, and in life too. I'm not. I'm more of a crybaby. So I think probably I wasn't conscious of it. I'm probably kind of subliminally, I was like cried because I related to Ducky probably in a lot of ways. And, had had my heart broken like every other human being. And I think that, you know, I didn't think about it. I just said, oh, I like this, even though it was a small little movie about a girl going over prom. I never thought, oh, you know, that's what I should do. This is going to be a big hit. Nobody thought it was going to be what it became.
Well, Charles brought up the cast, and I want to specifically ask about where Harry Dean Stanton came from, because he seems like such a left field choice, maybe in the breadth of his work, but even at the time, you know, Paris, Texas and David Lynch's movies and things like that. But yeah, he gives such an affecting performance. And I was wondering where the idea to cast him came from and what it was like working with him.
Yeah, John wanted Harry Dean Stanton. I didn't feel that strongly about it. And Harry Dean didn't want to do it. Harry Dean passed. I don't want to do that. And then we got a meeting with him. We went to his house, you know, and he was like, you know, very uninterested. And John never went ever to do stuff like that. John was like, not interested. I'm not going to beg somebody to do it. But he did. He wanted Harry. He knew. He was a brilliant at casting, John. And he, you know, look at the people that came up. Look at Macaulay Culkin. He found this kid who was like, you know,
yeah,
amazing, you know, when he was young. And so we went over there and I said, I remember this moment. I remember I think Lauren Shuler was one of the producers, said, well, we have to hurry up. Maybe I said, we have to hurry. We're in a hurry or something. He said, well, hurry up slow. And I went, hurry up slow. And that was it. He took his time. And then finally he said he'd do it. Yeah. And years later, it's funny. Years later, I did a television show called Big Love for HBO. And not Big Love, a different show. It was Getting On, but these old people in a nursing home. And he was in the cast. And he had dementia at that point, but he was still doing the show. He couldn't remember much. But I said, Harry, remember we did the, he goes, yeah, I do remember. And what happened to the scene that I did when I bought the pink dress? Why'd you cut it out? With dementia, he still remembered the scene that he missed the scene. Why did you cut it?
Wow. His story in that is really just beautiful. It's just your heart breaks for his character.
Yeah.
It's really beautifully done.
You know, he took a long time to say yes, but was he cordial on the set, or was he sort of grumbling about, I shouldn't have said yes to this?
He was Harry, you know, he was Harry. He, the scene with Ducky, I remember, you know, it was both because that was the character. He was a great actor, you know, right. And he was grumpy when he wanted to be grumpy to help that scene.
Yeah.
Remember the scene with Ducky, when Ducky and he was sitting in lawn chairs and Ducky says, I want to marry your daughter and blah, blah, blah. He was getting a rehearsal and he said, you know, I, he's talking about basketball. I said, you know, sometimes you got to feed the guy next to you. You shouldn't just take the shot all the time. And I mean, that's what they do. And he just kept talking basketball. I said, well, let's play basketball. So we rehearsed playing, but I couldn't get a basketball thing there, but I remember we were comparing moments in that scene to where you would give up the ball and feed or go for the shot, or take a wide, you know, long shot or go for a layup, or blah, blah, blah. You know, the comparisons or analogies with the moment in the scene.
We'll be back with more from Howard Deutsch after the break.
From the world of Sonic the Hedgehog, a new hero arrives.
I am
ready. Is there anyone stronger?
No.
Tougher?
No.
Funnier?
I do not make jokes. I make warriors.
Knuckles, now streaming only on Paramount Plus.
Yes!
Rise and shine, football fans. Start your day the right way with Morning Footy, a podcast that covers every aspect of the global game, headlines, match previews, analysis, interviews, culture, fashion, and plenty of banter. Join as we track the thrills and spills of Europe's biggest title races, the business end of the Champions League season, a summer packed with international competitions, MLS, NWSL, and much more. Subscribe to Morning Footy.
Did you have any idea that Ducky was going to be this controversial figure decades later?
Okay. No. But that was me, because John offered it to Michael Hall, and Michael Hall passed. And on many things, Michael Hall passed. You know, Kubrick asked Michael Hall to be in
Full Metal Jacket.
Yeah. Yeah. And they passed. I mean, nobody passed. So I didn't feel that bad about it. But anyway, no, I did. I remember at the time because Michael was huge from Breakfast Club and great. He was brilliant. But no, I had seen John Cryer in a movie and I can't remember which one it was. I think it was the one with Demi Moore. He had done a movie with Demi Moore. I forgot the title of it. And he came in an audition and, you know, he just broke my heart. He was just kind of like, all I felt after it was like John said to me, what is it about him? I said, I don't want it. I kept feeling like, don't hurt this kid. And he said, and then he took a look at me and said, yeah. And that was it. We went with him. And he was, and he basically lived with me. I mean, John and I were so close. We never, you know, it was all about living that character. And look what he brought to it, you know. I mean, talk about being, just be, you know, inhabiting something. You know, it was him. He became Ducky.
Well, I think Molly Ringwald has brought up that Robert Downey Jr. was up for it as well. Did he get close to getting the role? He just seems like he'd be too, it wouldn't be quite right for it. But I'm curious how, if he came close to it.
Oh, no, he was great. He would be great audition. He could act it, you know, for sure. He's a brilliant actor. Probably going to win the Academy Award.
Yeah.
So if he sees this, he's going to say, shut up. What are you talking about? But he would be acting it. Would it be like, don't hurt this guy? Maybe, because he, you know, he was vulnerable. But something about John and the humor John had, the kind of, you know, specific to him.
Yeah.
Not just, you know, funny, but character. He was, that was the guy for me. And so we just literally almost lived together for this entire movie and had all kinds of stuff on how to play this guy, you know, different codes we had with each other. Like, you know, when he, you know, he's had lacked such a large degree of confidence that we decided when he did feel a little confident with Molly, there would be, he would be able to get a slight boner. And it would be on a scale of 1 to 10. And I would just go 5, you know, said, two. You know, and it was like that, stuff like that, that, you know, that I could use again. But we had our own little universe with that character. And I think it stands the test of time. People love that character, except till the end.
Okay, let's talk about it. Let's get into it. Yeah.
Okay, so what happened was shocking. I almost had a heart attack because we're in a test screening in the theater at Paramount. There's a little theater there. I used to refer to it as the gas chamber. And so we go in there and you would test the movies. And it was like a rock concert. The audience was going crazy. It was, you know, I think the demographics were mostly young, but the girls and the guys were screaming for this movie, laughing, and they loved it. And it got to the end, and they started to boo. And we were just, I remember Ned Tannen and John were behind me, and they almost had a heart attack as well. They were like, what happened? And it was, they didn't want Molly not to get Andrew McCarthy. They wanted the girl to get what she wanted. They wanted her to get the cute guy. And that was the research, and that's what we owe him, was sitting there. We knew it. So John had to figure out a way to reconstruct the ending in a movie that was really built about, if it was about anything, it was about true love. You know, Ducky's whole life was dedicated to this, to Molly,
right?
To Andy. So, you know, Paramount was like, you got to figure this out. And he was in the middle of, I think, he was writing, was it Ferris? No, but yeah, he was writing Some Kind of Wonderful. So anyway, he came in the editing room once, and Richie Marx was the editor, a great editor. He's passed away since, but Richie was the Apocalypse Now editor. He worked with Jim Brooks on so many movies. And because we were sitting there, and John walked in, he said, I got it. And we were like, yeah, what? And he sat down on the floor. John liked to sit on the floor. And he sat there and he said, Andrew has to come alone. He can't have a date. Okay, then what? And then he go on to describe exactly what would happen, which is that Ducky would make the ultimate sacrifice and say, you're ruining the most romantic moment of my life. Go with that guy. Not in those words, but that was basically the idea. And so he gave her up. And then we had to protect his character and give him a reward. And so there was a little duckette, that little blonde, right. And he did a partake at the end.
Christy Swanson, not bad.
Yeah, Christy Swanson, yes.
Yeah.
Not bad. But Paramount was like, okay, great. You got one day to do it. One day to reshoot the entire ending.
Wow.
So it was challenging. And so, but we got it done.
Yeah, did you put it back in and did you see the reaction change?
Oh, my God. I think the scores went up like 25 points. It was like, you know, Paramount knew, ka-ching.
Right.
And it was, it worked. But who would have known? You know, I mean, the entire script was built for the ending of it. It used to end in Ducky and Molly went to the prom together. He showed up and it ended in dancing together in a swirl of pink and you're out. And that was an upside down world to get it to change it.
Did it change how you felt about the movie at all? Were you happy with this new ending?
I was happy because I survived. You know, I was too numb to like, I didn't not like it. But I think I was liking it more because it meant it might be successful rather than, oh, it's in my heart. It always had to be this way kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. I mean, the way that John Cryer plays the new ending, the way he, it just like, I was just watching it again last night and just like his performance there is just really wonderful. Your heart breaks for him and that sacrifice that he makes. But then he gets like, you know, he has the moment with Christy Swanson after that. And then I wanted to ask you about the moment where he breaks the fourth wall and looks right at the camera, which just killed me. I had forgotten about that. It's so funny. Was that scripted? Was that something that you just on the day were like, I mean, you only had one day to shoot this. And was John Cryer like, I want to look at the camera here. What happened?
No, scripted. Absolutely
scripted. Okay. Wow.
Yeah. No. And I was nervous about it, you know, but I think I covered it by doing one without it. But yeah, no scripted. Listen, John, he may be controversial to some people and, you know, all of that. But to me, he was a great champion and he gave me my chance and a break. And he was a terrific producer, nothing but support. And he came in and figured out that ending and it was a giant hit. So, and he was right. He had this antenna about what would work. I mean, he'd write scripts. I went on to do three movies with him and almost four. And he, you know, he would write, I'd be on the couch late at night, you know, and into the morning hours, he'd write at night and behind me, he'd sit and I'm on the couch. I'd fall asleep at the time, you know, like, and I'd wake up and he'd hand me pages, but he, would not finish half the scripts. He'd throw out 50 pages and I'd go to take them out of the garbage pail and keep them because I just would. But he knew when something was cooking. It's hard to see the forest from the trees like he was able to. He just had a sense of, for whatever reason, I'm not going to go forward with this. And sometimes it would be 5 pages left and he just didn't finish.
Wow. Do you still have some of those scripts you pulled out of the garbage?
Yeah. No, look, his favorite script that he was saving for himself, I ended up in rehearsal on, called Oil and Vinegar.
I wanted to bring that up. I Drew and I were just texting about that a couple of days ago. It was Matthew Broderick and Molly Ringwald?
Yeah, and I was in rehearsal, but it was an amazing script and amazing. And I wanted to do it always. I wanted to do it after Some Kind of Wonderful. And I remember going on the dubbing stage and said, I didn't want to do this other thing. I wanted to do that. So, no, it was before Some Kind of Wonderful. I said, I've read Some Kind of Wonderful. I'd rather do Oil and Vinegar. Is that okay? And he went, oh, sure. Yeah, that's fine. And the next morning, there was a padlock on my office at Paramount. I was thrown off the lot. It was like, yeah, no, it wasn't a good idea for me to suggest that. Anyway, we all worked out in the end and I ended up doing Some Kind of Wonderful. But that script was special.
So why did it never happen?
I was like, I had done three movies in a row and I was exhausted. And I was in a relationship with Leah Thompson and she was like, you're going to have a heart attack and you got to, and also, you know, we can't just, you got to get out of this. And I said, no. And so we had a fight and she went away. And then I realized that's a big mistake. So I just said, I can't do it. I can't do it. And I remember Tom, the editor, great editor, won the Academy Award for The Right Stuff, who was doing Gonna Be the Editor, said, you're so lucky to get this chance to do this. And I thought, yeah, he's probably right. And I was torn, you know, but I didn't. And I chose to get married to Leah. And that was it.
I think that was ultimately the right choice.
Yeah.
Yes.
Well, thank you for that, Drew. I'll tell Leah. Yeah, okay.
Yes. And that was it for part one with Howard Deutsch. And he was just a lovely, lovely guy, wasn't he, Charles?
Yeah, really lovely. And so many great stories. I mean, I know you know that we love hearing him talk about what he learned from Tak Fujimoto, just like how he learned from him. Like, how does the scene feel is what Tak would ask him. And so we love Tak's work.
Yes. Tak Fujimoto, if you don't know, has done a lot of amazing movies. He's probably best known for his collaborations with Jonathan Demme, I would say that, including Silence of the Lambs. But he also worked extensively with M. Night Shyamalan and a lot of other great filmmakers. And
I think early on, didn't he shoot Badlands for Terrence Malick?
He did shoot Badlands. He also shot Ferris Bueller for Mr. John Hughes. So,
right. Yeah. Just an awesome career.
Yeah.
Beautiful looking movies. So just across the board. So yeah, big fan of his. And also, you know, it's crazy. The Robert Downey Jr. as Ducky alternate reality is interesting to think about. And just the lesson in casting that we heard about that and how he felt that John Cryer was really right for the role. And I think that it's probably right. I don't know.
Yeah.
What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, the Ducky character has kind of had a reevaluation over the years, which is super interesting. But I think they made the right choice. And I think it's hard to... I think the reason why we're all fascinated by that other ending is because this ending is just so perfect and works so well.
Yeah. And it's fascinating to think about how much the chemistry between the actors changes things. And like John Cryer and Molly Ringwald, that chemistry wasn't the same kind of chemistry as what she had with Andrew McCarthy that like just felt like the audience like felt like they really wanted them to get together.
Mm-hmm.
And just, you know, as we learned from the Mission Impossible movies, the script isn't the end all be all. Sometimes you get on set, you put the things together, the elements go there, and you got to go where the movie wants to go.
Yeah. And I think it's a testament to the filmmakers that they listened to the test audience and they realized that there was a problem and they went back and reshot it quickly. And it's just amazing. It's amazing. It's an amazing what if kind of alternate reality. Yeah. Fascinating stuff.
Yeah. And another what if alternate reality is the movie Oil and Vinegar, which we didn't ever get to see, that would have starred Molly Ringwald and Matthew Broderick, written by John Hughes and would have been directed by Howard. And, you know, the plot of that movie, I'd love to track down the script and read it someday if it's out there. If anybody has it, let us know. But it was, a soon-to-be married man and a hitchhiking girl end up talking about their lives during the length of a car ride. And that's the movie.
Sounds great. Sounds perfectly John Hughes-y. And it would have been great to see what Howard Deutsch was going to do with it. But
yeah,
I'm sorry, Charles, that we don't exist in that universe.
Yeah, I guess it's just, it is what it is. It's not our universe.
It's not our universe.
And next week we'll get into Some Kind of Wonderful, which is a movie I know you and I both love. And he talks also about working with John Candy on The Great Outdoors, some good stories there, and then also more on Pretty in Pink. And we even talk about his episodes of Tales from the Crypt, which is fun to get into. You know, we love that show. And so is there anything else I've got a little something. Do you have anything else, Drew?
Well, I mean, I just have to remind people, as always, to like, subscribe, rate, and review wherever they're listening to this podcast, and to follow us on social media, whatever platform you're on. And our handle is Light the Fuse Pod, so follow us there. And what do you have to remind people about, Charles?
Well, I got to tell everybody that Pretty in Pink is available on Blu-ray, DVD, and digital, and Some Kind of Wonderful is available as a limited edition Blu-ray Steelbook, DVD, and digital. And we're going to do another giveaway because this is what we do, because we're just awesome and we love all of you out there and we want you to experience these wonderful movies. We know you love them. And so, yeah, we're going to do a giveaway of the Paramount Presents release of Pretty in Pink. It's a remastered Blu-ray. And then there's some kind of wonderful Blu-ray steelbook. We're going to do giveaways of both of those movies, John Hughes classics. So it's awesome. And you know, we've talked about it before, but those Paramount Presents releases are awesome. It's like Paramount's kind of like Criterion label, sort of. It's really great.
And they're also both available to stream on Paramount Plus. So,
oh, there you go. Hey,
you have so many options to watch these movies.
Okay. Well, there you go.
All right.
And so come back next week for part two. Light the Fuse, the official Mission Impossible podcast, is produced by Charles Hood. That's me and Drew Taylor. Our supervising producer is Abby Smith. This episode was edited by Luke Burson with music by Kevin Blumenfeld. This podcast is a production of Paramount Pictures. All rights are reserved.
Hi, I'm Joe Dante.
Legendary director Joe Dante.
And I'm Josh Olson.
Oscar-nominated screenwriter Josh Olson.
And nobody loves movies as much as we do.
Nobody's sane.
And we have a podcast.
Each episode, we track down other filmmakers, comedians, rock stars, authors, and artists, and talk to them about movies.
But not about their movies. Everybody does that.
We talk to them about the movies they love and the movies that have, well,
made them who they are.
Which is why we call our show The Movies That Made Me.
From legendary giants to this year's Oscar winners.
We know them all and we've seen them all.
So check out The Movies That Made Me, the Movie Lovers Podcast.
Available everywhere you find good podcasts. Well, actually, it's available wherever you find podcasts, even the bad ones. But ours is really good.
That's the idea.